Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of The Diplomat. We are in episode 4, and this is your host, Wissam Sharafuddin, speaking. Welcome, Dr. Ali Ajami.
Thank you.
Last time, we've reached to the point of your service in Muscat, the capital of the Oman, Sultanate of Oman.
Yeah.
And any events that are considered by you an important events during your stay in Muscat, diplomatically?
Diplomatically?
Yes.
It's in the form I formed, as I mentioned in other episodes, I formed the diplomatic committee in Oman, which it was not only for Arabs. We had even American consuls were members of it. So it was a matter of coming together, discussing issues. Sometimes I would have been so harsh on our American colleagues who were attending the meetings, negotiating there. Foreign policy, how they are dealing with the Lebanese issue, with the Palestinian issues, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good thing to remember.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time ago.
Mm.
We're talking about 20 years. Wow, 20 years.
1999 till 2002.
20 yes. years. Oh, I'm getting older.
In the year of 2000, freeing of South Lebanon took place.
Yeah.
The withdrawal, unilateral, yeah. unconditional withdrawal of the Israeli army from South Lebanon took place. You were in Muscat at that
yeah.
time. How did you receive the news, and what was your feelings?
It was something that we never imagined it might happen. But at the same time, we were always dreaming of it. I mean, it's not easy to get rid of this harsh occupation that were burdening your back since 1978 till the year 2000. It was an amazing joy. I don't think there was a Lebanese that would not feel this joy. And don't forget, Wissam, it was for the first time ever the Arabs managed to have a real victory in their long, long dwell with the Israelis.
Right.
It was something,
mm-hmm.
it was a joy.
Was there any official event that took place in the embassy with the consulate?
No, but just to let you know that at that time, the number of the Lebanese immigrants working in Oman was about 300.
So, mm.
Now there are more in thousands, but at that time it was very, very little.
Mm.
The Lebanese preferred to go to the Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
To Qatar, to the Saudi Arabia, but not to Oman.
Mm-hmm.
It was far the most remote area in the Arabian Peninsula.
Yeah.
Yes, far away.
What's your opinion about the leadership in Oman?
To be frank enough, the man just made a big jump for his country. And he took over, I think, 1970 or 71 from his father. Before Sultan Qaboos, mm-hmm. Oman was living in the dark ages.
Mm-hmm.
Completely dark. I used to meet with Lebanese that were living in Oman before and then after. Oh, the way, it's not only a job, it's a lab, a huge lab mm-hmm. to modernization. Despite, and I'm not talking about political issue, but I mean social, the progress in the country, it was really amazing. By the way, maybe people do not know exactly, but Oman and Sultanate, and Sultanate and Muscat in principle is a very charming beautiful city. The country in general is very, very, very unbelievable. It's beautiful. So I don't want to talk about politics in Oman. It's something belonging to them. But yes, with Sultan Qaboos, the country went to a new era, new generation. The progress is more than overwhelming.
Yes. Oman, you said you don't want to talk about the internal politics of Oman, but it remains as a country in the Middle East, one of the very few neutral countries. It has not gotten.
I can talk about this, and the neutrality of Oman is surprising. And imagine a regime or a country, whatever you want to call it, that can build strong relations with the Americans and with the Russians, with Saudi Arabia and with Iran, with the Palestinians and with Israelis. They are on a very excellent relation with all parties. That's what makes them easy and exactly to play the role of the go-between. In most of the negotiations that took place between those fighting fractions might go through the Sultan himself or through the Sultanate. Is this welcome? Is this good or bad? We are not to judge.
Right.
If you want to talk, if you want to ask me my own personal view, I am against anyone who builds a relation with the Israelis. But I mean, as a country, maybe they are convinced this way. They are away from even no internal conflicts within the Sultanate. You don't hear that there are some kind of political opposition that is fighting against the regime. You can't see it. Maybe there are some kind of conflicts within the royal family itself.
What are the main resources in
Oman? You have some. They don't have this much of petroleum as the Emirates or as a gas as Qatar. They have some petroleum, and they have a lot of metals in the mountains, rocky mountains. They have beautiful mountains full of iron, of different metals in it. Yeah.
And how is the freedom of press and freedom of expression?
I don't think that this is a wise question.
It's an Arabic country.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything we need to talk about Oman before we move on?
Yes. I want to talk about a moment that I can never forget. September 11.
Oh, that's right.
I was in. I was at that time.
Shame on me.
No, at that time, I remember very well. It was in the afternoon at the time in Oman, maybe about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening, and I was walking on the beach with my wife, just strolling on the beach, and there are a lot of cafes.
In the Corniche?
No, on the beach.
The actual beach.
Yeah. And on the beach, there are a lot of cafes that you can have your shisha or you drink coffee. So, and there was a big screen in one of those cafes. Well, what's happening? It was, I mean, when the second plane hit the tower, I saw it with my own eyes at that time. And they were running on CNN live footage of all those. It was really, so we stopped, we just sit down and sat down and watching what's happening, what's going on. It was really, you know, that...
What came in your mind at that time?
You know, history is changing. The history of the region. I automatically, without any doubt, the accusations would go to the Islamic extremists. That's automatically to Al-Qaeda. That was obvious even before they started accusing and before revealing the truth about who abducted the planes and who was on them, etc., etc. But the main idea was that this was the beginning of building, of creating a new era in the Middle East. And it happened. Since that time, see what huge changes that took over, starting invading Iraq and later on the war in Afghanistan and so on and so on. It was a turning point in the way the Americans and the West in general dealing with Middle Eastern issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In 2002, Doctor, you were reassigned towards Lebanon.
Yeah.
What was the reasons?
No, usually after 7 years of service abroad, you have to come back to the administration for 1 to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's something just a routine.
That's if you're a consular. That doesn't apply to ambassadors, right?
Even to ambassadors, 10 years of service abroad.
Mm.
But for consuls and council, it's 7 years. So by that time, because I started moving around at the year 94, 95, so 2002, that was 7 years and a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought back to the administration, to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beirut.
For you were expecting it.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't a surprise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not, it was not favorable because it's not easy. And this is one of the real problems that any diplomat faces, moving in and moving out.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard. Not only building relations with people. No, even if you want to adjust yourself, your family. Coming to the country, renting a new house, buying new furniture, registering your kids at schools or universities. And then when you want to move out, you have to sell your things. Take your kids out of school and move back to another place or to Lebanon, whatever. It's not an easy thing to do.
Does the move usually take place during the summer?
It should be,
mm-hmm.
because due to schools, you have
right.
to send you. But sometimes they don't care about this.
Mm-hmm.
But usually it should be by July, August, they will nominate you.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to for you to prepare yourself well and to start moving to the new position.
2002 to 2004, Doctor, you worked as the in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Lebanon. And you were head of the Asian, African, and Australian desk.
Yes. Yes.
That's a big position with
yes.
so many
Yeah,
files.
You have three continents. It's true.
What's exactly your job?
The political department in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's divided into different desks. One of these desks, in the political, I'm talking about the political department, there is the desk of Asian, African, and Australian desk.
Is that one desk?
One desk.
Hmm.
And we have, our relations.
How many desks there is? If
you have the European one.
That's
you have
one
the European
desk.
One and the American one.
American, both, north and south, that's one desk.
Mm-hmm. So we have three main desks,
three main desks.
The largest is...
And does desk mean a department?
It's a part of the department,
okay.
A department within a department.
Mm-hmm.
You have, you are in charge of this desk, but your supervisor is an ambassador,
mm-hmm.
usually,
mm-hmm.
who is the head of the diplomatic, of the political affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So we report to him,
mm-hmm.
and he, in his turn, reports to the minister himself.
Right. How was Lebanon in 2002?
It was, we were still rejoicing our victory on Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And, what happened later?
Were you happy that you moved back to Lebanon?
I don't think
expected.
I don't think there's
were
any...
Were you awaiting it?
Awaiting, yes. Expecting, yes. But loving, you know. Nobody, I don't think there's a Lebanese diplomat would love to go back to the administration for a lot of reasons, mainly for financial issues. Because, you know, the financial status when you're a diplomat abroad is not the same financial status as a diplomat at the administration. At the administration, you are a simple employee, just like any other administrative employee at any ministry. But a diplomatic status, you hold it when you are abroad with all the benefits for all the and if the financial advantages you have it. So there's a big gap.
Yeah.
And you will be living this high.
You go down.
And suddenly, so imagine, I mean, you are sending your kids to universities. And you could be, you are able to pay their fees because you are abroad. And then now when you go back home, you don't have the same financial capacities to fulfill all these, even your way of living. You cannot afford to live the same way as you've been living abroad. So this big gap, it affects a diplomat so much. That's why I don't think there's a diplomat, a Lebanese diplomat, that would love to come back and work at
Where the wife and kids happy?
For the kids, I mean, they for sure they were not happy this much. Because it's not easy. In every couple of years, you just move them from one school.
But they know school. It's going to happen.
Yes. Yes. They know. But even if they know...
But they have no friends in Lebanon. They have no.
But yeah, but they have. I mean, this is one case. I mean, when we were in Brazil, they had a lot of friends, and when we moved to Muscat, they were supposed to not and to forget about those in Brazil because at that time we didn't have the way of communication as nowadays. No social media, no cell phones, etc., etc. So when we went to Muscat, they started to rebuild new friendships, new acquaintances. And then when you go to Beirut, you leave everything behind and you start over. And this is not easy, even for the brains. But they managed with this continuous moving from one place to another with their confrontation with different civilizations, different languages, that enriched their own mentality, their own personality. Yeah.
You have not lived in Lebanon since 1994.
Yes.
And you went back in 2002.
Yes.
That's 8 years.
Yes.
How did Lebanon change?
The changes you cannot deny it, but at the same time you don't. I didn't see that there was a great change that I don't know, because every year I was
you
coming
visit.
To because in Oman is just nearby, so every year we come two or three times to Lebanon, so we were always following up.
You're in touch with Lebanon.
Yeah.
Did you live in Beirut at that time?
I don't. I had a house in Beirut, but I love to be in the south always.
Would you go every day and come back?
Usually, no. We stay in Beirut, but and during the for the weekend, from Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we were in the south.
Odyssey.
Yeah.
During that time, there was a lot of pressure on the Syrian interference in Lebanon to end and for the Syrian troops to withdraw.
Yeah.
Did that affect your position in the ministry?
No, not at all. But, I mean, we were following that. And it's something understandable. This is Lebanon. You have different political fractions. Everybody is fighting for his own cause. We don't have, just to be frank enough, I don't think there is a common cause for all the Lebanese. What this fraction considered to be a real cause, the other fraction or the opposing fraction has a different view. Mm-hmm. That's why what happened, I consider it to be a natural development in the Lebanese diagram in general. It wasn't change. It wasn't strange. It wasn't okay. I know very well that the withdrawal of the Syrians from Lebanon was not expected this quick. But what happened, I mean, mainly with the assassination of Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, that was a bewildering event. And everything after it, with it, was really possible, including the withdrawal of the Syrians. Mm-hmm. Although it was really astonishing to see the Syrian army that took over. Nobody can deny it, even those who were governing Lebanon at the time, nobody can deny that the Syrians were the real governors of Lebanon. Nobody, even the Syrians themselves, they admit it. Even all the political leaders that were at that time in Lebanon, also they admitted that during 15 years in Lebanon, the Syrians were in charge. So in a sudden, one day they left. It was really surprising. Mm-hmm. But I consider it, as I said, as a natural development in the Lebanese map, Lebanese political issues. That's, to me, it was something in a very not strange enough, very normal. Surprising, yes, but not strange.
Mm-hmm. The president of Lebanon at that time was Amin Lahoud.
Yeah.
What's your opinion of
him? I love the guy. I consider him, beside our actual president, he was the real man, if when I use the term man. He was a man of honor, he was a man of decision, a man of integrity, a man of principles. He stood firm with the resistance in Lebanon, and he continued to be.
Even after consider him, if you rank presidents in Lebanon, what would you rank him?
Number one.
Really?
Yeah. Mm.
Dr. Ajami, any important file that you can share some information about that passed by your desk during that time? I know that maybe many of the files are confidential, but 2002 to 2004,
Asian,
African, Australian desk. What is your day-to-day job?
We have, you know, we were in direct relation with two sides. One, our embassies at these, you know, we have a lot of embassies in Africa, mm-hmm. we have a lot of embassies in Asia, and we have an embassy and two consulates in Australia. So
you're kind of support for these embassies.
Yeah, and at the same time, we are in direct contact with the embassies of these countries related to these continents in Lebanon. So we were in
liaison.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That was our job. Mm-hmm. I don't recall that there was
Do you consider moving to Lebanon was less work or more work?
No, at this desk, more work. Because, you know, when you are in Muscat or in any embassy, you are dealing with issues of this country, the issues of your community living in this country. But now you are dealing with, you know, in Africa, we could talk about, I don't know how many, 20, 30 embassies, mm-hmm. In Asia and in Australia. So altogether, we have more than maybe 40 embassies and consulates in these countries. Add to them the embassies of those countries in Lebanon. So you build up a lot of work.
No.
I was not the only one. We have a lot of diplomats, a couple
working
of them.
Working on the same desk.
Yeah.
Yes. In 2004, I want to ask you one question before we move from Lebanon. Did you go back to the Muntada al-Saqafi bil Abbasiyya?
For sure.
This the cultural forum of Abbasiyya?
Yeah.
You got involved again?
I got involved again, and I remember that they did an event to honor my presence again, because they considered me as the godfather of of this Al Muntada, which I'm really proud of being a part of it, or of forming it since the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In April 2004, you received the news that you will be the Consul General of Lebanon in Detroit.
Yes.
Was that a happy news?
To be frank enough, the first step, it wasn't at all.
Mm.
And I was really... Because I was anticipating
that's
to be...
That's considered a big promotion.
I was aiming for a higher position.
Which is ambassador.
Yes. And I, at was that
expecting
time,
it?
I was expecting to be nominated as an ambassador to a certain country.
Mm-hmm.
Not, because we are not, as a Shiite, you cannot be an ambassador in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's always for
divided,
either.
Divided, yes.
So I got nervous. I was not happy at all with the nominations. And then I went to visit... President of the Parliament, Mr. Nabibri, because he there's something easy to say, and you know, he is the top ranking official as a Shiite in the country in
yes.
general. So I went to him, and he asked me why you are not happy. They told me that you are not happy in going to
Detroit.
I told him, in fact, yes, because I was expecting something else. He told me, believe me, you will be happy there, because I have been there. You feel that you are going from Burj Rahal to Burj Brajni.
That's
so
exactly
you,
what he said.
Exactly.
Right?
I remember the word. ما رح تزعل رح تحس إنك رايح يا عبنت جبال يا عبرج براجني يا عبرج رحال. I remember those words. And if, in fact, that's
true.
What happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely true.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, he told me that a different, I mean, you are aiming to, I know that you're aiming, but it's not for this time.
Mm-hmm.
Next time you'll be,
mm-hmm.
not now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened.
Yes. Just for our audience to who might not be aware of the Lebanese politics.
Yeah.
Can you recap to us al-muhasasa, the sectarian division of positions in the Lebanese government, yani, which is not in the constitution?
It is.
It's not in the constitution. It's tafahum.
It is. No, my dear friend. It became a part of the constitution. With a Taif agreement, it's written now. Before, it was just a verbal,
Taif
as they call it.
Taif agreement is not part of
it
the
is
constitution.
A part. It is the constitution now. Let's be frank enough.
Mm-hmm.
Before, it was, as they call it, a gentleman agreement between all political factions and religious factions in Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
that the president of the republic should be a Maronite, the prime minister should be a Sunni, Muslim Sunni, and the speaker of the parliament should be a Muslim Shi'i. That was a verbal agreement.
Arranged by France.
By France, and then it went on among the Lebanese officials and all that stuff. By, this goes on to all positions in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Even, yani the chief, the army chief should be a Maronite. The governor of the central bank, who is responsible of all the money, should be a Maronite.
So the number one person is always a Maronite, the number two a Sunni, and the
number
two
is Shiite. Number two, the speaker of the parliament is number two.
It's considered higher.
Yeah, yes, than yes, yes. Number three is
the prime minister.
Yeah, number three is prime minister.
Okay.
So this went on as a verbal agreement, as a gentleman's agreement, till the Taif agreement, which took place in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Between Lebanese parliamentarians that met there, and they issued this, and this was reconfirmed after that in the at Doha agreement later on, that brought General Sleiman to be a president. So now it's written. Okay, you want to tell me it's not a constitution, but it's a written agreement. It's written that this president should be this, speaker should be that, prime minister should be that, and so on. And this is really something that blocks your dreams. Imagine you are a Shiite, and you dream of being a president. You cannot be.
Even if you convert.
Nobody converts. But it's really a block, a blockage to all your...
But I mean, technically, even if a person, just for our audience information, even if a person converts, that doesn't count.
It doesn't count. It depends when he is converting. This makes you sometimes feel a feeling of uneasy, of unease. You are not happy. I'm not happy with it. My religion belongs to me. It has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with anyone else. I'm free. I want to worship whoever I want to worship. Nobody is responsible for me. If somebody is going to judge me, it's the Creator and I go to him. But the unfortunately in Lebanon, it's not this case. You have to be always, you have to measure your steps.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be always to know exactly where you go. You are in, when we were at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we know the limit. We are Shiites, and the one who is responsible for the nominations in general is the Speaker of the Parliament. He is in charge of it. The Prime Minister is in charge of the nominations of the Sunnis. The President mainly is responsible for the nominations of the Maronites and so on. And this is really crazy, but this is a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to coincide with it, you have to go with it. If you are not in good terms with your leader, with your religious leader, you might not find yourself in a suitable position.
Right. So, you were nominated by...
not by him. He approved me to be Consul General of Lebanon in Detroit.
Was there any news that you knew beforehand?
Yes. Before him? No.
No, beforehand. Like... Has this been anticipated?
Let me tell you also it's a secret.
We'd like to know how things work in Lebanon.
I could talk about it because I retired and the man in charge at that time also retired before me.
Uh-huh.
He was the general.
And this is witnessing for history.
He was the general director of the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, his name was Naji Abu Asi, an ambassador, a very fascinating man. I really loved him, and he loved me so much. At that time, I was, as I told you, I was in charge of the African Australian Asian desk. So he called me to his office, and he showed me a paper with my name on it. Beside the name, written, Consul General in Detroit. And he told me that this paper, we got it from the office of Speaker Berry.
Mm-hmm. Was it handwritten or typed?
Handwritten. Handwritten.
His handwriting?
I don't know his handwriting, but I think from his office.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he told me a very funny thing. He said, with you, the Shiite, it's so easy for us at the ministry. When we want to do the reshuffling and the nominations, for the Shiite, there's only one man who decides, who is Speaker Berri.
Yeah.
While in the Sunni section, for sure you have the Prime Minister, but at the same time you have a lot of other leaders, Sunni leaders, party leaders. You have the Bizri, you have the Saad, you have Miati, you have Salam, you have a lot of them that may interfere. The same thing for the Christians, Maronite and other fractions. Even each leader has their own point of view. They might be in favor of nominating this person, not that one. But for the Shiites,
yeah,
we have this handwritten paper from the office, and it goes
like this. Is it still the same case, or there's more Shia now that interfere?
I think it's regarding nominations at the administration. It goes back to Speaker Birr.
Was there many choices, and then he shows you, or limited?
No. Let me tell you something about before maybe decades in. They usually give you an option to choose. You name three positions, and they give you a lot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
You have to name three of them that suits you more, and they will choose one of them. It's no more the case. Now they will just decide, Ali Ajami, you go to this post.
Appointment.
You don't like it? You stay in the administrations.
Mm-hmm.
And for sure, we have to like it.
I mean, his choice of you.
Yeah.
Was it based on his personal relationship with you? Or was it based on that he has limited choices and, you know, he shows you? Or was it based on merit? Where
you could consider it all together. I was on good terms with him, and my reputation in the places I served were really...
Mm-hmm.
good in Brazil, in Oman,
in
Egypt.
In
yes, I succeeded. In, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a very, very, very excellent relation with him in person.
Mm-hmm.
I usually, anytime I come down to Beirut, I go and visit him and sit down. Mm-hmm. He asks me a lot of things about how's my posting, how's the.
You so, consider yourself a friend of him?
I should. Yes, we should be.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Close to him, yes.
So, for example, between 2002 2004, your stay in Lebanon, how many times you'd say you'd visited him?
You can't every now and then go and knock on his door, but a lot of times. I don't remember how many, but I've been there
numerous.
A lot of times,
mm-hmm.
numerous times. I would be going with my colleagues, also Shiite
mm-hmm.
diplomats at the ministry. We go to visit him. Sometimes
right.
we have some problems with the minister. We complain to him. To resolve it, because you know, at that time I remember.
Although officially,
yeah,
that's not the line of complaint.
Yes, but this is Lebanon.
Yeah, and it's probably confidential, even.
Exactly.
He shouldn't know about it.
Yeah, at that time,
you know, okay.
He knows everything. Don't worry.
Yeah.
And not only him, all the leaders know everything about everything.
Right.
Yeah.
The country is not run by the constitution or the laws. There is an internal agreement that things are run by.
I'll tell you, with a lot of pain deep inside,
mm-hmm.
The country is not running at all.
Mm-hmm.
The country, with what you're hearing, we've been living in the heart of this cycle that goes on and on. Every year, and it's going backwards. It's never going forward. What you see now is a result of the way all the fractions, all the leaders dealing with nobody, none of them. I don't want to say that they don't think, maybe they thought of building a real country, but in fact they didn't. What we saw now, maybe it's not their fault, maybe it's the main fault of the French when they built up this country
mm-hmm.
in 1920 and then 1943. You cannot build a country on religion. A religion is a way, as I mentioned, is a way to worship whoever you believe is God,
mm-hmm.
your God, your creator. But it cannot be a part. You have all. If you want to build a successful country, you have to distance between religion and administration. That's what makes Europe a very successful continent when they
separated.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
State is something, church is something else.
So really? You believe in separation between church
and state? Exactly.
When did you start believing that?
Is
that
since the big, since the very okay. beginning of my life?
Mm-hmm. Have you expressed it, or it's just?
I always said it, but I mean, who cares?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Okay. Who cares?
طيب دكتور احنا we're not gonna have time to go to America today.
Yeah.
We're gonna go in the next episode to Detroit, which is a very dear chapter of
of my life. Yeah.
And it's one of its results is this podcast itself. Mm-hmm. But before we go there, I want to just put some ending points on the on this subject. Is there something that during your stay in Lebanon, have you felt that there is something that you would prefer to have done other than being a diplomat?
In fact, I would love to be a diplomat before 1992. You know, as I mentioned earlier. Other episode that I passed and the exam for that in 1982, and from 82 till 92 I was on the waiting list, so I would have preferred to move into the diplomatic life in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
It would give me much richness in my life.
Right.
It's not it's something. Sometimes I considered myself a very lucky to live this wonderful life.
Right.
Of a diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy thing to do, to travel the world, to get in touch with a lot of civilizations, a lot of people, their languages, their traditions, their habits, their food, their culture, their books, etc., etc. This thing, if you are at home in your country, you won't have the chance to do all the stuff. I did it, and I loved it very much, despite the difficulties, as I mentioned before.
Right.
But it was a very interesting phase of my life,
mm-hmm.
being a diplomat.
So I know if I asked you, if you talk to a young man or woman today that want to go into a diplomatic career, I know that you're very encouraging of being diplomatic. But I want you to give me your opinion about a young man today graduating from University of the Lebanese University and wants to go on a diplomatic career.
What should he do?
Do you encourage him?
For sure.
And what is your advice to him?
Yeah.
He has no relationships. He's not relative to any. How can he make it?
You know, in Lebanon, it's not a secret to say that you cannot go to such, we call it high positions.
Mm-hmm.
Being a diplomat, reaching to the level of an ambassador, it's a high-ranking position. You cannot reach that far without a push.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't lie, if you don't have a back supporting you, as we mentioned it, you won't be able to make it. I know that sometimes people pass with their own capabilities, but not everyone. Usually, I mean, the support is essential. If I had the support at that time when I passed the exam, I would have been a diplomat since 1982. But because I didn't have this father to bear this back,
mm-hmm.
to push me, I didn't have that push at that time. I was on the waiting list for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's your advice for this graduate?
Do your best if you can. If you can do it without having a back to push you, if you can. I know it's not an easy thing,
uh-huh.
at all. In a country like Lebanon, it's not an easy thing at all. Not only a diplomat. Any high-ranking position in Lebanon needs uh-huh. to be agreed upon, passed by your political, religious leaders.
During this 10 years wait, did you have a point where you were hopeless about it?
I forgot about it completely.
You were completely hopeless.
We tried. We were six of us that were left over from those in at 1982 exam. We passed 24. We passed the exam.
Mm-hmm.
They nominated 18 right away,
mm-hmm.
and six of the rest
six. The 18 that had backs.
You could say it. Uh-huh. And so we waited. We tried our best with the president at that time, with the prime minister. Hopeless case. Mm-hmm. And I remember very well, 1983, the prime minister and the minister of foreign affairs, they signed our decree, but the president refused.
Wow.
And he, at that time, he was Amin Jmayel. Mm-hmm. And I remember very well his words. That was when we asked why he didn't sign it. One of the ministers told us that he said, how can I sign it for them? And there's no one of the phalangists among them. You know the phalangists?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How can I sign it for them? So, I forget about it completely. I continued working as a teacher from one side, as a journalist from the other side. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, we were under the Israeli occupation, 1982 to 1985. And later on, a lot of events went on. And 1989, I immigrated to Switzerland. I ran away for my life and for my kids. And then, in a sudden...
Who gave you hope in 82 to apply?
Me.
I'm 82, you're under occupation, you have no direct relationship with, and the government is in fractured, and they are in opposition of each other. You know that the president has to sign. It seems very, I'm very impressed by the hope that you had.
It wasn't a hope, it was a defy. Mm. I was defying myself.
Mm.
You know, and adding to all what you're mentioning, I was recently graduated. I had my BA in Arabic language and literature. And this exam to be a diplomat, you have to pass an exam: international law,
geography,
constitutional law,
history.
Political science, constitutional law, international law, economics. And which I had nothing to do with that.
You studied that by yourself?
By myself. I remember very well, there was a friend of mine with his name, I still remember him very well, his name is Ali Zain. He had a bookshop at Barbour in Beirut. We always go there to buy books. I brought the list of, they gave us a list of what are the materials you'll be examined about. I gave him the list. He gave me about 20 books. And I had 3 weeks. I studied for 3 weeks. All the books. And I went to the exam, which is very tough one. Very tough one.
Yeah.
And I passed.
Yeah.
It was a defy to the self that I can do it.
Yeah, and doctor, I want to say something to the audience. That the circumstances that you were living in, to break all the odds and get a diplomatic position eventually as an ambassador among these circumstances, with your circumstances, with your personal circumstances, the background that you come from, is equivalent in America to a person coming from a middle class family to become a billionaire or to become the president or senator. It's such an inspirational story if people understand the perspective. Did you talk to people at that time? We're over time, but did you talk to people and they discouraged you? They told you there's no way or that you have no chance?
I talked to no one.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I told my mom, mm-hmm, I want to do it. She was still alive at that time. And
mm-hmm. Did she encourage you? Was she happy about it?
Yeah. She doesn't know what does that mean, mm-hmm, being a diplomat, mm-hmm, or not.
Mm-hmm.
But
why didn't you tell others?
Everybody knows that I went to the exam. Mm-hmm. All my villagers,
uh-huh,
all my colleagues at the school.
Uh-huh. Were they encouraging? Did they have hope for you?
They would tell you that you could... I remember one of my friends at the university, he told me that you could do it.
Mm.
You could do it. I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved
Did someone told you can't do it?
You could hear it. I mean, it's if you don't have a back to support you,
uh-huh,
it will lead you to nowhere.
But you believe that you can do it.
I believe in myself, in my capabilities, in my...
You believed in the country, yani. And you had hope that you will break through that system.
I broke the system. I went through it. Mm. But did I succeed to make a change in the country? I don't think so.
Were you official member of Harakat Amal?
No, never.
I want to ask that question because there's some rumors sometimes that mentions, Dr. Ali Ajami is part of Harakat Amal. That's why he became an ambassador.
To tell you a secret, maybe people doesn't know. I started my political life being a communist, not with Amal movement, but I left all political parties involvement in by the beginning of the war, because I came to realize that it's all in vain. I saw dear friends of mine
in 75 years.
I saw dear friends of mine that went to fight in the battle of Damour, and they were killed in vain. Why? Why? So I didn't see that there is much hope of working with politics.
In 75?
I quit.
You quit and never and back that's it. Into...
And I have never been. I was a very close friend to a lot of ML movement leaders. I was, you could say, yani, with, as I mentioned in other episode, my relation with Muhammad Saad, who was the leader of the resistance at that time, and he was an Amal movement leader, but he was the leader of the resistance, and I was his buddy, if you could say. If he wants to deliver any issue, any political statement, any thing about the operations, the ambushes that the resistance are doing, you give it to me. I was a very close friend to Dawood. Dawood also, he was a very, he was the real leader of Amal movement in the south.
Right.
When Nabih Berri was the leader in Beirut.
So you easily could have been, but...
I was in very, very close relation with him.
And I
very
know that,
close.
But forgive me for asking the question, doctor, because wanted to record the answer.
I've never been a member of the NAR.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ali Ajami. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for following us. The Diplomat, Episode 4, with Ambassador Dr. Ali Ajami. We'll continue next episode, Episode 5, with the movement to Detroit. And thank you for following us on Dearborn Blog, Dearborn Blog Podcast, and for supporting and sponsoring this this podcast. If you're interested in sponsoring upcoming podcasts, please visit dearbornblog.com. And click on sponsorship. Thank you very much.